welcome back to Cairo Nights. You've heard a lot on this show. We have gone round and round about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and how websites should be regulated. We've talked a lot about Twitter and Twitter's decision on who it allows on the platform and who it doesn't, including the biggest news lately of President Donald Trump's Twitter account and then Facebook account both being, and other accounts actually, all being eliminated as a result of the Capitol riots and Parler getting deplatformed because of allowing, again, not moderating its content. And there are people out there writing about this in a really interesting and informed way. And one of my favorite newsletters is called Today in Tabs. And if you haven't, if you're interested in these issues, you really should look it up and subscribe. The founder and author of the newsletter, it's a daily newsletter. In fact, it's kind of a funny, I like his description of it. It's a daily newsletter. The broad description is about society and technology and the internet, or as the founder of it, Rusty Foster, refers to it, the internet compressed as tightly as I can get it. Rusty is joining us tonight on Cairo Nights. Rusty, thank you for joining the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So one of the reasons I really like your newsletter is you really push up against the issues that we can kind of censor out there, but we don't really know how to articulate. I think people like me who are a little more, who are interested, but maybe a little bit more of a casual observer. And your most recent provocative newsletter was the headline was Donald Trump was right about one thing, which actually ends up turning out to be a bit of a bait and switch. But the point is that this thing that we're running into, this issue with Parler getting deplatformed and the president being canceled on Twitter, like these are the public acts of something bigger that's happening out there, and it's involving the internet and the internet information providers and regulation. Now let me for the first question then, when you saw Twitter eliminate Donald Trump's account, what was your reaction?
Oh boy. I mean, the first reaction was, I can't believe it took them this long. Like, if I were running Twitter, I would have been desperate to get rid of him a long time ago. But also, if I were running Twitter, it probably wouldn't be as successful as it is. So there's two sides to that. You know, Donald Trump has always been an enormous hazard for Twitter in terms of just like his presence has always been a risk. There was a risk of driving people off. I mean, I use Twitter a lot less over the last 4 years because he was so omnipresent. Even if you don't like him, you couldn't get away from him on the platform. But at the same time, you know, his follower count was something like 50% of Twitter's daily active users. So like them taking him off is a big deal. It was a big choice. I think they felt finally like they absolutely had to, because whatever happens in the next week or two, they were at risk of getting blamed for it. But also, you know, in the last day or so, the New York Times has been doing some reporting about the reactions to the, you know, Twitter banning Trump and Facebook banning Trump and all of the other platforms banning him. The reaction to that around the world, a lot of it is like, hey, why aren't you banning our autocrats? Why aren't you banning the people who are abusing the platforms in our countries? So that was always the risk that they were weighing, was that as soon as they ban someone like Trump, everybody in America and everybody in the rest of the world is going to have an opinion about who else needs to be banned.
Well, and yeah. you also wrote about in the newsletter something I wasn't aware of. So Twitter is now sort of in some ways kind of finding religion about who it allows on the platform and what they can say and who it doesn't allow. Although it's applying that, I think you would probably agree, pretty inconsistently. But I didn't know.
Yeah.
What you pointed out was that, for example, if you don't want neo-Nazi content on your Twitter feed, you can essentially establish on Twitter that your country of origin is Germany, which actually doesn't allow that from a regulatory right. standpoint, and suddenly it will disappear from your Twitter feed, even though you're in the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And for many years, I mean, I found an example of it going back to 2017. I didn't hunt further back than that, but I've known about it. I mean, a lot of people have known about it for a long time. It's just Germany and France specifically, and possibly other countries, ban Nazi content. It's just illegal there. So for Twitter to be permitted to operate in those countries, they have to be able to identify and remove it. And the way they do is just by a localization flag that anybody can set. You can say, my country is Germany, and it will apply German laws to your Twitter feed. It doesn't change your language or anything. Like, nothing else changes, but it will get rid of content that isn't legal in Germany and France. And it's not, you know, it's not a filter that will take out everything you don't want to see. It's like very specific, but it's Nazi content specifically. So if you're getting a lot of Nazi content in your Twitter feed, probably like unfollow some people first.
Yeah, right. But it can speak to bigger problems.
Yeah, they have tools. They can identify this kind of content. They can hide it if they wanted to. And I guess, I mean, I always wondered, why did they want to host Nazi content in America? There are free speech arguments for doing that. You know, we've gone back and forth on this in this country for a long time. So Twitter as a service in particular has always been very committed to free speech, possibly to its detriment or to its users' detriment. They have been saying, you know, since banning Trump, all of these services have been trying as hard as they possibly can. Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg in particular have been trying very hard to make it, you know, make the case that all they're doing is enforcing their existing rules and that this is not a change in policy and it's not anything that's going to affect the future or any other countries or any other situations, but it's simply applying the rules that they have, which is, I don't know, sort of good luck making that case because right. Twitter has been making exceptions for the rules for Donald Trump for a long time now.
We're speaking with Rusty Foster. He is a reporter. He reports on the internet. He's the founder and editor of the daily newsletter Today in Tabs. Rusty, so I think the really good point that you made about that you could set your country of origin and it doesn't change anything other than the filtering that's applied to your content kind of puts the lie to this idea that I mean, Twitter's always sort of held back and we are free speech and we, you know, we didn't realize that this stuff was going on and we need to do a better job of moderating. But the fact is they do a phenomenal job of moderating when there's regulation that demands moderating. Is that a fair way to look at Twitter?
I think it's fair. You know, people have been asking for a long time, if we can build tools that are that good, why can't, you know, for example, rather than moderate content, why can't you give users tools to moderate their own content? We're talking about like Nazi content, but just being an ordinary woman on Twitter has been a terrible experience for a long time.
Right.
It's just the harassment is almost nonstop for a lot of people. You know, so women have been asking for a long time, like, why can't we get better blocking tools? Why can't we share block lists with each other? Why can't we, you know, people have built third-party tools where you could identify one person and then block everybody who follows that person, which can take out a huge swath of, abuse and harassment. Why isn't Twitter building those tools? They've never had a good answer for that, really.
So when we're looking at this, I mean, essentially what we're asking Twitter to do is not just really moderate content, but build a, and Facebook as well, in an even a bigger way, looking to build a business model that doesn't actually exist sort of on this content, this really, you know, caustic content at the best. I mean, do they need to actually rethink the entire business model that they've built these giant companies on? Facebook, you know, has admitted in other countries that its content has led, and you point that out, has led to real social problems. In fact, people getting killed. They seem to always in the United States sort of like, we're trying, but
right.
It appears that they could actually be doing a lot more than they are. What's the solution here?
I mean, I think you touched on it. It's there's a problem with the business model, which is the more engagement and the more content that you provide to a Twitter or to a Facebook, the more they know about you, the better they can target ads to you and the more money they can make on those ads. So that's the business model. And they've built very sophisticated algorithmic feeds that are designed to keep you engaged and keep you posting, keep you reading. And so, you know, we've seen certainly that it's, you know, particularly on Facebook that, again, the New York Times has been doing great reporting on this, where they've demonstrated in a few specific users that when they started posting really, really incendiary, like right-wing content, their engagement shot up immediately. They gained followers, they gained activity, they built big communities, and the more they did, the more that Facebook rewarded them for that. I don't think that it's Mark Zuckerberg is like sitting back there and tuning the dials to make sure that people get all this like right wing, you know, fascist content. But I think that they built a machine that favors extremism. And there's a lot of evidence that is true, including the evidence that, you know, during the election week, they actually sort of turned down the extremism dial and suddenly the top shares went from really, really far right commentators and opinion people to like NPR and the BBC. It was an experiment, and it worked. People's news feeds got a lot more reliable and a lot more sort of straight news. And then after the election, they turned it back off.
Right, right.
Presumably because engagement went down. So, yeah, the business model relies on engagement and relies on people providing information. And as long as that's the case, you know, they're walking a fine line. They're going to try to keep you there as much as they can. And if an algorithm does that, then they're going to keep it.
We're talking with Rusty Foster. He's a reporter on the internet and the founder and editor of a daily newsletter called Today in Tabs. Well worth you reading it. So, Rusty, then you also mentioned, I mean, so we've got that one issue. They clearly are not always being, say, candid with us about their actual ability to control the content on their sites because they make money. Whether or not the content is something that we find offensive or not, they want the most engagement, the most content. And it turns out that some of the stuff that gets a rise out of people tends to be the most engaging stuff. But also, let's step back on these two. Let's just use these two platforms as an example, Facebook and Twitter. And the ability to sort of encourage all of this sort of like gathering point to really click on the brightest possible light to bring the moths in, and then suddenly click that light off when they decide there's too many moths or they're not a moth of a type that they want. I mean, should, and I think you've contemplated this, should anyone actually have that power? It's not really a free speech issue as much as it is, I don't know, maybe an antitrust issue.
I mean, this is the point where, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I think that there are a lot of legal issues that I can't necessarily speak to with all that much authority. But you wouldn't be the only one to suggest that there are some antitrust issues that could be raised potentially. You know, when it comes to moderation, moderation is always a problem because one person's favorite content is another person's like least favorite content. So, you know, it's, you can't ignore the fact that Donald Trump has spent the last year or so hammering on Section 230 and saying that, you know, Facebook is stifling conservative voices, which is patently not true.
Right.
But they are always getting yelled at from both sides. And anybody who does any kind of forum moderation is always getting yelled at from both sides. You always know that whatever action you take is going to upset someone. Yeah, I mean, at the end of my post, I think, and as soon as I posted it, my smartest friend, who is trained as a lawyer, immediately told me I was an idiot. But what I tried to suggest at the end was basically just that there needs to be, you know, as long as it's just a sort of open field and everybody can do whatever they want as far as, you know, collecting data and doing whatever they want with it and trying to make as much money as possible, the incentives are always going to be what we have now, which is just maximum engagement at whatever cost, at any cost. And I hear a lot of commentary on sort of what can we do, what can be done about Facebook, you know, why aren't there more services? Is it a monopoly? And I just would love people to think more about regulation. Like, what are the ways that these problems could be addressed at a legal level? It's not an easy question, and I don't mean to imply that it is, but there are people much smarter than me that are thinking about it.
Well, so let me ask you again about the regulation issue. One of the more interesting things that I read was this idea of, yeah, you can get them to regulate the content. Let's just use the Germany example that seems to somehow ferret out the a lot of the Nazi and neo-Nazi content, so you don't see it there the way you would see it maybe in the United States or some other place like that. But one of the smart commentators on this, and actually I think this was a research paper, I don't remember which school it was, talked about the algorithm that actually does make, like, pulls in that reiteration, the thing that gives you sort of, you go for a penny and it gives you a pound as far as whatever content you're looking for, the thing that actually sort of like starts filling your feed with, like you said, rewards that sort of like engage. If you engage in something that is a little bit caustic or extreme, it really enhances your exposure to that.
Yeah.
Even if it knows you're enraged by it or if you're pleased by it, either way, it's going to really enhance that. And that is actually written into the software. I mean, is it conceivable that you start regulating the actual algorithm without actually regulating maybe the content itself, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's a, it's an interesting thing to consider. And it's how you do that exactly is difficult to think about.
Right.
Yeah, my background is as a programmer and as a creator of web software. So I immediately go to like what exactly does that look like in practice and implementation. I guess the things that I would think about are more about outcomes than about like specific software details.
Right.
But you know, YouTube is infamous for this, where like you can click on one perfectly innocuous thing in YouTube and then a week later it's giving you absolutely nothing but Proud Boys, you know?
Right.
So for a lot of people, YouTube has been just an absolute grease slide into like extremism. And it's because of the way that their recommendation algorithm works. If you like something, it'll give you something that's just a little bit more than that, and then a little bit more than that, and then a little bit more than that. And there should, I'm like, it seems to me that there should be ways to measure that. That sort of like, is your recommendation radicalizing people?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's sort of the open question. We're talking with Rusty Foster. He is the editor-in-chief of Today in Tabs. He is a reporter. His background is in software engineering. It's a daily newsletter. I highly recommend it. So last question before we let you go, and thanks again for joining the show. When you see this, do you feel like that this coming year, this is what I think I started our conversation off air with, that this coming year is going to be like this struggle to find out these giant companies that we sort of allowed to be built in the United States, that we're now finding that they're starting to devour things we weren't really anticipating? Do you feel like this is the year where there's going to be a real concerted effort at regulation, or is there just too much money to be made for anyone to really take that seriously?
I honestly don't know. What happened at the Capitol, I feel like, goes back to, at the very least, to Gamergate in 2014, which was, God, we don't need to tell that whole story, but essentially a mob of gamers ended up mobbing and harassing a certain list of women on social media. And that spilled out into the real world as well. And it's that kind of that sort of online mob has been created and recreated several times since then. And I think the Capitol uprising, whatever you want to call it, was the most recent instance of it, and probably the most destructive instance of it in this country. But again, back to Myanmar. I don't know. I don't know what it takes to get our government interested in doing that. There's been a lot of hearings, but nobody's really done much.
No, not so much.
I would hope that people are thinking about it more now. It's way past time. But typically, technology regulation in particular tends to happen long after it should have.
Right. That's an excellent point. That is Rusty Foster. He is the editor-in-chief founder of Today in Tabs, a newsletter, as he puts it, the internet compressed as tightly as I can get it. It's a fascinating daily read. Please check it out if you are interested in such things. And Rusty, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
More to come on Cairo Nights right after the break. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. One of the situations that you always hear from folks who cover the tech industry or who cover the Pentagon is that frequently the experts that are developed in universities, the experts that end up in government agencies, get plucked away by private industry because private industry can pay so much more than the public sector can. But recently at Seattle University, According to GeekWire, Lisa Stifler at GeekWire, there was a situation that was kind of a unique response, maybe a solution to this idea of pulling talent out of public institutions and putting them in the private sector. And it's essentially in form of a ransom for these people. Lisa Stifler, thanks for joining us here on Cairo Nights.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. Glad to be here.
So one of the things I dug about this story was that this is a constant refrain at the University of Washington, Seattle, universities all over the place, is that it's hard to keep talent because the private sector will cull the best people, offer them a ton of money, and yank them right out of the schools. What happened with Seattle U that was a little bit different this time?
Well, what was interesting was Seattle University had a head. I'm sorry, I'm going to do that again. Seattle University's chair of their computer science department is a woman named Roshandel, and she was the first woman to hold this spot, very accomplished. And Amazon was able to woo her away. And what's interesting is she had actually done a year-long sabbatical with Amazon starting in October of 2018 and then continued on working with the company after that, even after she had returned to Seattle U. And she did an interview for a publication with the university reflecting on that sabbatical. And you could see that she really enjoyed the experience. You know, she talked about her observations of how competitive it was and that she would be able to kind of bring some of those lessons back to her students. But then she also was clearly in admiration of the kind of talent that she was getting to work with and sort of the entrepreneurs who were part of the program at Amazon. And so, you know, if you were to kind of read into it a little bit, she clearly was pretty charmed by that experience. So, you know, it maybe wasn't too difficult for them to woo her away.
Right. Of course, you know, because it's, and that's true. I mean, once you move into the sort of the private sector like that, it doesn't kind of move at the glacial pace of academia sometimes. And it also puts you in an environment where it can be highly, highly competitive. But in this particular circumstance, Amazon, while taking away a considerable talent from Seattle U, then did something else in response, right?
Right. And so what happened was they turned around and, you know, talked with the folks in leadership at Seattle U. And it sounds like Seattle U is who approached them and said, you know, can we do something so that you can help us replace her? Because, you know, especially she wasn't just a professor there. She was the chair of the department.
Right.
And so to be able to recruit someone of really high magnitude so you can kind of keep really talented professors and students coming to your program, you need someone with a pretty good sized reputation. And so what Amazon agreed to do was to provide a $3 million endowed chair. And I should be cautious to say Amazon won't confirm that number for us.
Right.
We had access to an email between the Seattle University's faculty and leadership, and they shared that number, but that Amazon and the school would not later confirm that. But a $3 million endowed chair is a pretty big deal for drawing someone to that spot. And what's also interesting is that one of the vice presidents at Amazon is also a trustee at Seattle U and a graduate of the university. So there would certainly be an inroad there to have that kind of a dialogue for that to happen.
Well, now, do you see this as being, because like we said earlier in the segment, this has been a complaint from institutions since I've been aware of them, that big private companies can pluck the really good people because, you know, obviously the salaries are the pressure is higher, but the salaries are also so much higher and stock options and things like that. Plus somebody gets to say maybe a little bit more current in their field because they're sort of at the cutting edge of it. Do you think that this is going to be one of those things that other schools are going to look at and say like, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is something we can actually pull something back from a Microsoft or from an Amazon or from an Apple when they pluck one of our prizes away from our schools?
Well, that was absolutely the message from Ed Lazowska, who's a longtime leader in the computer science department at the University of Washington. He was really applauding Amazon sort of for making good on taking this talent away from academia. And he really is hoping, you're right, that this sets a precedent, that the tech companies see this. I mean, it's a great way to burnish their own reputation,
right,
by sort of having these endowed chairs, and would probably be a good tool for recruiting, you know, other graduates to come to their companies, you know, because it's called the Amazon Endowed Chair. And so, it's a great way to promote. And so, you know, Ed in particular was calling out Facebook, which has apparently tried to poach from the University of Washington as they paying attention to this. He also told me about an approach that Google has, where they will borrow, you know, faculty for a period of time and then pay a postdoctoral researcher to continue whatever that professor's program was, so that then that person can step back into the academic setting after they've contributed to, you know, Google's program in some capacity. So that's kind of another way to look at not having it just this one-way flow out of academia.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because it, like you said earlier, I mean, that schools, when they get somebody really talented as the chair of a department, that people sometimes don't realize this, who are outside of academia, but that's used as a recruitment tool for not just for students to go there, but for other, maybe, you know, promising graduate students and promising people, you know, who may work at a lower level or at an adjunct level. That's sort of the magnet for all of those things. And so, when you lose that person, you don't just lose their talent, but you also lose their magnetic force on a university,
yeah.
Right?
Right. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that's it. They're sort of the sun, and they've got your satellite of different researchers around them that are doing related work that kind of all builds on it, for sure.
That is Lisa Stifler, reporter with GeekWire on Seattle University, hatching a pretty interesting deal with Amazon to lose a valued professor and department chair, but gain an endowed chair and some money from Amazon in the process. Lisa, thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Thanks so much.
One of the things I really liked about this story is I like it when a university essentially makes lemonade, sometimes when it's handed a lemon, because it really is distressing to universities to get someone really talented and then just have a big company that can way outbid them pluck away someone really good. And this seems like a fair trade, like, hey, take our person, but leave us in a position to replace that person, you know, with an equally talented or somewhat equally talented person. And this was the really smart move that Seattle University did to sort of perpetuate what is considered one of the better programs of its type in the state. Coming up on Cairo Nights right after the break, it is the Random Question Robot. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. So we are at that stage, end of the week, last round of questions before we can go and think of additional answers that we should have said over the weekend. But right now, we're just going to have to do the best we can. Both of you, I assume, are ready.
Yeah.
Ready as you're going to get.
Yeah, tank's half full, but I'm here for it.
That's all right. Well, at least it's not half empty.
That's true.
And Frank, you're ready to go, correct?
Sure.
Absolutely. Awesome. Shane, first one's for you. What out there desperately needs to be modernized?
Oh, wow. Desperately needs to be modernized. I'm going to go out on a really big, crazy limb here. I'm going to say some religions.
Fair enough.
You know, I mean,
that's an interesting answer.
I mean, there's a certain point where the times always change and there's going to be different sets of standards. And I feel like there's a lot of different people that get ridiculed, get pointed out, get spotted, just based off of these ideals that we've had for such a long, long time. And I feel like it is a big stem of a lot of bad stuff that comes out of a lot of things that come with good intentions. So I think if we were able to, you know, figure out a way that we could find a balance between modern times and what we see in, you know, some of our scriptures that we have that we all live with and abide by, I think that would be a great thing.
I think that's a super great answer. Frank, I will not get anywhere near Shane's lofty territory. I'm going to go really basic on this one. Smart traffic lights. I am appalled at the notion that Seattle has like improved its traffic light flow. And I guess it has in some places, but I don't know how many times I sit at otherwise deserted intersections waiting and waiting and waiting for a light to change. Or there's a whole line one direction and zero cars the other. I'm going, what is smart about this? And they claim that they've done this all over town, but I have yet to see any sensors in place that seem to recognize that stuff, except in a bad way.
Okay, so I'm going to do something that's trains. I think we need to modernize trains. I mean, when you really think about it, we're still using technology that is, what, probably 70, 80 years old? Diesel trains, right? I mean, can't we modernize, particularly passenger trains?
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah?
But, you know, I'm certain that with enough money, Amtrak's going to be in the 70s anytime now.
Yeah, right.
All right, let's move it along. What, Frank, have you done wrong most of your life but recently found out the right way to do it?
Oh, there was the word that I spelled incorrectly for so many years and then found out that I had been correcting it and editing it, and I can't remember what it was. It was relatively... Dilemma! Dilemma! I spelled it with an N.
Well, that's ironic.
We were taught when I was growing up, I'm sure I was taught this, D-I-L-E-M-N-A, and it's not. It's double M.
Yeah. I think I was taught that, too, because I couldn't figure out why I kept spelling it wrong. And I think way back when, they just added that N for no good reason.
It does exist. If you go back in history, it exists in English literature. But
still for no good reason.
Right.
And that's an appropriate change, I think. Shane?
You know the artist Sade?
Mm-hmm. Sade. S-A-D-E?
Here we go again. I learned just something new right now on air. Yeah. I always pronounced it Sade because it's S-A-D-E. And I recently learned that I've been saying it wrong for the longest time.
Yeah,
and
you're still saying it wrong.
And you're still saying it wrong, but now you're saying it right, so you can actually answer that question again.
Oddly enough, Sade.
So I was going to... What was I... I actually was... Oh, I know what it was.
What?
It was... boiling an egg. I finally read a really great article by a guy who was a sous chef who literally had to, for a big restaurant, had to boil eggs for like salads and whatnot all the time. And the way you do it, I was doing it where, you know, you put the eggs in the water, it'll raise the temperature, blah, 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 boil a certain... Wrong, wrong, wrong. And if you want to make good hard-boiled eggs, this is the way you do it, because you can actually get them to peel perfectly every single time.
What is it? Quick.
You boil the water first, lower them in slowly after the water is boiling for, I think it's something like... 12 minutes, not even quite that, like 8 minutes. Then you take them out, immediately put them in an ice bath. They pull away from the shell. They peel perfectly 100% of the time now.
Okay, I'm fascinated.
Yeah, it really... I'll send you the... I was like, I don't know how to boil an egg, please. Why am I going to read this? And it turns out I didn't. And it turns out he was right, and it works beautifully.
Wow.
All right. That's it for Random Question Robot, folks. Thank you very, very much for joining us. And we will be back at the top of the hour with Stacy, who is going to talk. She's going to give one. We know the Seahawks are out. She is going to give her whole lineup of predictions for the upcoming playoffs. Stay tuned. And if you want to compete, 98973, text in your answers.